On this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, Dimension 20 now have something in common with Taylor Swift.
Mostly Spider-Man.
Something of magnitude has shifted within Daggerheart.
I want to reserve judgment on the system itself.
It has the crunchiness of 5e, but it has the freedom of loving improv storytelling with my friends around a table.
Customers of Hasbro at large are higher than ever, so players are happier than they've ever been.
If you go by Baldur's Gate 3, I'm sure they are.
I literally have like four fidget spinners and
that's why we call you Fidget McLaughlin.
You've never called me Fidget McLaughlin, but
not to your face.
All that and more right now. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG podcast in all the realms. That's right, it is time for your dice picnic. Let us roll out the little checkered picnic mat. We got our snacks here. We got our whiskey for Sean. My name is Ben Byrne. I'm joined, as always, by Sean Merwin. And this week, standing in for James Hake and Dale Kingsmill is Monty Martin and Kelly McLaughlin, the Dungeon Dudes. Welcome back, gents.
Hey, how's it going?
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so glad to be back.
Monty, I have to ask, through your life, if you've been to live events, concert, band, play, D&D actual play, what is the best live experience you've had, one that really sticks in your memory?
Cirque du Soleil is pretty high up there. Even as a little boy, when the clowns gave me the nightmares, it sticks with me to this day. It's an utterly mesmerizing experience. Canadian-based circus company, but they do tons of shows in Vegas and all throughout the world. And honestly, just the artistry, the athleticism, the music, and everything is absolutely stunning from beginning to end.
So mine is definitely music based. I've gone to a lot of concerts in my lifetime, and I love going to concerts. And my favorite band is kind of tied here. I've seen my favorite band is Blink-182, and they put on a show in early 2000s that was extremely memorable. So I'm going to say there's a tie. There's a tie between two. Blink-182 did a show where they had a giant flaming F word on the stage, and Travis Barker, who's the drummer of the band. He was on his own platform, and there's a drum solo in one of the songs, and the platform lifted up, started shooting fire, went out over the audience, and started turning upside down while he was strapped into his seat doing a drum solo. And it was one of the craziest things I've ever seen. That is tied with Roger Waters performing Pink Floyd's The Wall start to finish with a full... the band was on stage performing, but there was like at one point a toy airplane flew over our heads and exploded into a wall that they were building on stage. There was giant walking puppets through the audience. It was insane. It was the most theatrical musical performance I've ever seen in my life. So Roger Waters performing Pink Floyd's The Wall was probably one of the most stellar experiences of a live event I've ever had in my entire life.
I'm just trying to picture a drummer being like flown through the air with the drum kit.
Wild. Look it up. Look up Travis Barker drum solo with fire, and I'm sure you'll find videos of the insane. Yeah, he's wild. It's great,
and probably a couple of recipes too.
Yeah.
When I was a wee lad, not wee, but younger, the Folies Bergère in France, I saw as a kid, and it's sort of the Cirque du Soleil, but before that was a thing. So acrobats, comedians, a little more risque stuff going on there. But it was something that even though I saw it when I was probably 17, I still remember. Sporting event. I was at a very famous baseball game that happened at Yankee Stadium back in the 80s. George Brett, who was a famous player at the time, hit a home run to supposedly end the game, except he had pine tar too far up the handle of his bat, and so they called him out instead, and it became one of the most famous games ever played. And I just happened to have been there the one time I went to Yankee Stadium. I was there for that game. It was quite an experience.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of folks who have those stories of like that one time that they were there for the things that folks have heard about. Mine is more of a near miss. The thing that stands out to me was seeing Linkin Park, who are my favorite early 2000s band.
Yeah. Nice.
Who I think this was 2007, 2008, they came to Australia. They did two shows. I was there the first night. The second night, Chester jumped on stage, caught his foot, fell backwards and broke his wrist. And they had to end the show early because he had landed on his wrist. And so, yeah, it was intense. The audience apparently were very understanding when they came out and they were like, yeah, look, he's tried to sing through a few more, but he's in a lot of pain. We got to get him out of here and took him to the hospital. But yes, that one has stuck with me. Speaking of expensive shows, this is an interesting story because Dimension 20 now have something in common with Taylor Swift, and that is that you cannot get tickets to their Madison Square Garden show because they have, and I have confirmed this for the moment, I believe, sold out. I don't know if it was a pre-sale, special sale, get your tickets early sale, and whether more tickets are going to be miraculously discovered, like the secrets of the Lost Ark and then given to the part. I don't know how ticket sales work, except that they had dynamic pricing from, what's the company called? Live Nation. Which means that the faster people buy tickets, the more expensive those tickets become, kind of in a sort of demand versus supply type situation. The tickets, I believe, were priced at about $100 at base to start with, and they rocketed up to $300 to $800 pretty quickly due to that dynamic pricing before they rocketed even further to over $2,000 a ticket to get close to the stage, which is a lot of money to go see some people play D&D. Fans not happy. Dimension 20, obviously, you know, having anti-capitalist kind of messaging in their show a lot of the time, have since come out and said, A, they didn't necessarily know about the dynamic pricing or that it was something they could opt out of. They have since opted out. Two, that they're introducing a lottery system for select folks to purchase $35 tickets across the venue from the best seats to, I don't know, the worst seats or the not so good seats. And three, that they'll also be recording the show. I have no concept of Madison Square Garden except that it's the place I swing over the top of in Spider-Man and get real annoyed because suddenly there's no tall buildings for me to latch onto. Is this a big venue?
Big enough.
Yes.
I've also never been there. I just, mostly Spider-Man.
Mostly Spider-Man.
Yeah. It's not the largest venue that you could see a show at, but it is definitely on the large side. And so if you get an act that's quite popular going through, they will play three or four shows there to serve the entire, you know, audience that could be there. So it is not the hugest stadium ever, but it is a large arena.
Is this the biggest live show in a role play, you know, context ever now? Because we know Critical Role did what, 14,000 over in the UK earlier this year or late last year. We talked about it. This is a 19,000 arena stadium seated arena stadium place.
It's impressive, and I think going back to your previous point about the dynamic pricing and all that, I don't blame Dimension 20 or hold any grudges against them for the prices skyrocketing. If they didn't even know that dynamic pricing, they probably had no idea it was going to shoot up like that. And the fact that they took actions to like try to solve that problem actually makes me respect them quite a bit. That instead of being like, yeah, you can pay thousands of dollars for our tickets because that's awesome, they went the route of being like, oh, that shouldn't be happening. So I think that that's really cool on them. And I think it's really cool that we're seeing an age where TTRPGs can sell out an arena. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty wild. I'm kind of the mindset of if you're seeing a show at Madison Square Gardens, you're in New York City, you're in for a penny, in for a pound. And I kind of say, like, good for them for getting whatever price they can for a ticket. Seeing a show in New York of any kind is always going to be an expensive prospect between hotels and accommodations and travel. And you know, Madison Square Gardens is a historic venue. I mean, $2,000 for a ticket is pretty high, but I've paid that much for concert tickets before. and you know, if you want to draw the comparison to, you know, industry size and notoriety. Like, you know, Dimension 20 are the rock stars, like Dimension 20 and Critical Role are the rock stars within the sphere of actual play. So I feel like if people are willing to pay $1,000 for a ticket to see them, that's how much a ticket to see them is worth. Well, I don't not share their sort of views on capitalism. I also think we're all trying to make it in this world, and the basic fact of reality is that we all need to eat and pay rent. So so get yours while the getting's good. Because I think especially for actual play, it's actual play is a very precarious thing, and like there's only a handful of actual plays. I would hazard to guess that Dimension 20 and Critical Role are probably the only actual play shows that aren't operating at a loss for what it costs to produce them, right? Like, and I would probably, like, I have no insider knowledge beyond just talking with others on this, but like, there's not many people that are turning the profit to begin with when it comes to actual play.
And I think it's important not to say, well, if Dimension 20 does it, how come this artist, you know, who is on a 70-city tour doesn't also do it? Because it's a difference between a one-off, one-time, when you're already making your money somewhere else doing this stuff, than it is for someone who makes their money because of the tour doing it over 70 shows and having to pay for lights and equipment and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So don't compare apples to oranges there. You know, kudos to Dimension 20 for doing what their fans would want and, you know, getting out there to be seen. But don't compare it to musicians or other acts that rely on that money over the course of several years to make a living.
Yeah, that's fair. I think as well, like, while I subconsciously convert everything into Australian dollars, like when you tell me a ticket's $100, I'm thinking it's 100 Australian dollars, not 100 US dollars. So my thoughts on this might change with more appropriate context. But I do have to admit, when I was trying to find the actual price of tickets, $100 or $95 or 119, I think, is the average that people have paid so far. Because when the dynamic pricing exploded, according to Dimension 20, nobody really went in and started purchasing those $2,000 tickets. Everybody was trying to see if they'd come back down.
Yeah.
So maybe they got away lucky with that in terms of not having to refund anybody given this change in policy. But $95 to $120 does sound cheap to me for this sort of show, you know?
Yes, that is a good price for any sort of live event. That is an excellent price. You'll spend more on a Broadway show. Just across town, not even.
Here in Australia, a lot of the live plays that we have tend to get up on stage, particularly at conventions, particularly at comedy show, at like comedy festivals. It's become a really big thing here for people to get up and do their live plays in person. Have you gents ever done your live play in person, or has it always been pre-filmed?
It's always been pre-filmed or streamed. We've talked about doing it live, but honestly, when we do it live, hopefully someday we do, but I would be happy to, like, if we filled a room of 200 people, I would be like, wow, that's awesome. Yeah. And I know that we have the audience to do that, but it's less about, like, do we have the audience to do that? It's more about, do we have the audience in the specific area at the con that we are choosing to be at to fill a room? And, you know, there might be several thousand people that watch our show, but I wouldn't count on several thousand people showing up to watch us at a con necessarily. So I'm happy. I would be thrilled to fill a small room with fans. that would be a dream come true.
I guess the question, not so much around like what expectations of audience would be, but like what, because I know, Monty, I know you particularly have a lot of experience in theater. Kelly, I assume you do as well in some capacity. Like what would be the drive to want to, how would you change what you do? What would you want to do on stage specifically, even if it was, you know, at a con in kind of a conference room type situation?
Honestly, the con would be by far and away the hardest place to do it. Because a lot of cons are pretty when it comes to like setting up an actual play, especially if you do want to record it, which you do in a lot of cases, like bringing the recording equipment and getting all that organized in the space and at the time, it's a pretty daunting prospect to get it all together. And so I think that, you know, I would much prefer to organize that kind of thing at a more performance oriented venue where, you know, in a lot of convention spaces, you might not have the time to do setup and tear down as much as you would want to. Whereas in a dedicated venue, especially somewhere that was more of like an improv comedy venue, and we have some fantastic improv venues in Toronto. And I think that some of those would be my first choice if we were going to produce one, because I think that they're small, they're intimate venues. A lot of them, you know, you can get a pitcher and some wings while you're watching the show. And to me, that seems like the perfect sort of setup. And the venues have the experience and the support for doing that kind of thing. That's where, you know, you just have to figure out the logistics for a ticket price, right? I think at a convention, I know quite a few people that have done the convention thing, and it's a lot of work. Like, it can be doing a live play at a convention can be the thing your entire convention weekend has to revolve around. So
yeah.
So that's why we haven't done it ourselves yet, because we didn't necessarily want to make the whole weekend about just trying to get that off the ground.
Yeah, it can be. We've done them at PAX Oz the last 2 years, and it is very like the panel before you is on, it's finished, you got half an hour, go, let's get everything set up, everything on stage, let's get it all happening. And then at the end, it's like, all right, we've got another panel coming in, or it's the end of the night and all the technicians want to go home, go, get everything off the stage, let's get it all done. It is much better to do it earlier in the convention, so that then you can be like, okay, Friday night's over, now it's Saturday and Sunday, it's all gravy, as opposed to doing it like the last thing on the last night of the convention, which we've done before. Oof. And it's just, everything's like, oh, well, I can't relax yet because I've got this thing coming up. I hope I've prepped well enough so I can throw it all in the bin immediately when the players start interacting with it.
What do you think, Kelly?
I do think that, I mean, if we did do it live, like to go back to the original question, Ben, of like, what would I change or what would I look for? The one thing that I would probably have to get used to is an audience reaction to us. And, you know, like, we crack jokes, and like, if we're laughing, then there's a pause. But sometimes we crack jokes and then just carry on. And like, you know, the audience could burst out laughing at something that I said that I didn't even know was funny. And we have to do the appropriate pause for that. And that would be probably an interesting thing, but also I would thrive on audience reaction to our actual play. And not even just for me. Like, I know that I'm not the funniest one at the table. Joe is the funniest one at the table. And when he delivers a one-liner and a room full of people burst out laughing, I will be fueled by that energy I feel like our energy would be much, not necessarily much higher, but there would be like an electricity in the air for an actual play that happens live. And I would be excited to experience that. I don't know yet what it feels like. And so I would kind of love to know what that's going to feel like.
Sean, I know you've played a lot at conventions with public people, but have you ever played in front of people?
Only a handful, maybe 10 or 12. Nothing of that magnitude.
Well, speaking of magnitude, something of magnitude has shifted within Daggerheart, the new RPG that is currently in playtest coming from Critical Role. Man, that segue was smooth as butter. I don't think I've done a smoother one, and I just ruined it. They've made a couple of tweaks to their playtest, which is coming only a month after they initially put out the playtest packet. So you have to assume some of these changes were changes that they had in mind initially, or they are reacting very quickly to audience feedback. One of those potential reactions being that they've already added an optional initiative style system, which was originally absent from the game. But before we crack into those changes, I want to ask Sean, because I assume that you played I think it's 1.2 and the latest one is 1.3 that they've released. You played Daggerheart just recently. How was your experience with that system?
I played with a very, very competent game master in many systems. And so I knew I was going to get a good experience. And I also played with players who are great role players who have played at a variety of systems.
Sure.
So playing Daggerheart for us was sort of like falling out of a boat. It was very easy to hit water because Daggerheart pulls from so many different games that as we were making our characters, we're like, oh, that's just like 13th Age. Oh, that's just like this. Or, oh, it's very similar to that. So character creation, especially using Demiplane, went very quickly for us. So within an hour, we had completely made our characters. We understood how the game was working. We had our connections, our bonds to each other. And then we played for 2 hours, which involved only one combat because I role played my way out of a combat. Unfortunately,
By design.
I wish I hadn't, but there we go. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. I want to reserve judgment on the system itself until I read the rules and play a little bit more. But if you are a player or a game master that is proficient with storytelling games, you will take to this game pretty quickly as it's currently written. But it is not a rules light game by any stretch of the imagination. Okay. In fact, I think it is just the opposite. There are a lot of levers to pull in this game, and I'm waiting to see when you get a very experienced player pulling those levers in the most optimal way, what the game will look like.
Yeah.
Or if you have a game master who's not a great storytelling game master, who relies more on the rules to tell the story, what that experience will be like once the final version of the rules come out. Because that's where people usually get into trouble, is if they're used to a game where the rules hold most of the weight, when they're asked to make these storytelling decisions that aren't rules implemented, it can be tough. It can be a heavy lift for both game masters and players in those cases. So I think it's going to be a good system. I think it will work really well for a critical role to play and show people how it works. How it goes beyond that is yet to be seen.
Okay, I have a question that might frustrate some people because I'm going to ask you to compare it to 5e in some capacity. And I think a lot of the audience will be like, oh, everything comes back to 5e. But it's really just for my, like, it's to have a measuring stick, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think 5e as a system, based on those two things you just said, how will it function, Daggerheart I'm speaking about, with optimizers and people who really want to try to optimize that system from a player perspective, and how will it perform with a GM who might not be great at storytelling, but they've got good system mastery. Mm-hmm. How do you feel 5e performs under those two, through those two contexts, right? Because 5e is obviously a game that can be very optimized. Mm-hmm. How do you think it plays when you have a GM who's maybe relies more on system than storytelling?
I think that's one of the strengths of 5e is you can have a game master that isn't the best storyteller, but the rules themselves, you can spend an hour just in combat and the story takes care of itself in a lot of ways in that. The tension of that story is, do we defeat the monster or not? And so you don't need to ad lib. Now you can, and that's what's also great about 5th edition is a lot of people that have played many different games understand the storytelling aspects that they can bring in, even though it's a 5e game. So I can make some, what would be the success with a complication factor in Powered by the Apocalypse games, and I can bring that into a D&D game. Oh, give me not diplomacy. What's the other one? Persuasion check to convince the chamberlain of the court to do something. Oh, you rolled a 12. Well, okay. Here's what happens. And I give you two choices. Do you want the truth, but something, or do you want this? Right, you can make it up as you go if you have experience with those other games, even though 5e doesn't support that.
Mm.
And that, so that's one of the reasons why I love to see people play other games, so they can bring some of that stuff that's not necessarily in the rules, but the storytelling aspect of it, they can bring into those, they can bring into 5e, even though there's no rules for it.
I think we did an entire video about stealing that mechanic from Powered by the Apocalypse and using it in D&D, and that there should be more degrees of success in your D&D games. But I think in general, I mean, Ben promised to run Daggerheart for me before the show started today, but he failed to do so. So blame him for me not having played Daggerheart yet. But I think it sounds like a system that I would grasp onto really well, because after I learned all of 5e, 5e just became a tool belt to me that, like, I rarely open a rule book anymore for 5th edition. I almost, like, when I run my games, I don't even have the adventure book I'm running in front of me. I read the chapter, set it aside, and then I have my monster stat blocks and some point form notes, and I just go. And that's how I run my games now. I run a lot of Monster of the Week, and that I do even less. I literally just have some point form notes and a basic, and the list of, like, moves that the players can do. And that I ask them for. I mean, in Monster of the Week, which is Powered by the Apocalypse, the DM doesn't roll any dice. You're literally just a storyteller. Daggerheart sounds like it's going to fall somewhere in the middle, where, like, it has the crunchiness of 5e, but it has the freedom of me just loving improv storytelling with my friends around a table. And so that strikes me as something that I'm very keen to dive into.
Can I ask you, Sean, about your experience with the combat specifically? I don't want to speak for Dante, but Dante doesn't have a voice on this podcast outside of the editing.
Poor Dante.
He got to play it a couple of weeks ago, and his experience with the combat and the lack of an initiative order meant that it took a really long time to get through a fight. There was no limit on how many actions any character could take, is my understanding. And so people would just kind of keep be like, and then I'll do this as well. Because one, you know, what was your experience like?
My experience was great because I had a game master who runs Powered by the Apocalypse games all the time. And that's how Powered by the Apocalypse games generally work. It's whatever makes sense for the narrative that you're spinning is how the initiative works. If this person has to go four times to keep the story moving forward, this person will go four times. That's just the way it is. I saw that they added this initiative light system where you only get so many actions. That will probably help. That might not be enough for people who are used to an initiative.
Yeah.
But if you can do it well as a game master and as a group of players, it really makes sense to run your story-driven role-playing games like that.
One of the big sort of secrets of just what we're doing in Monsters of Drakenheim with the epic boss rules, it is kind of like a PBD. Like, there's a whole bunch of systems where, yeah, it's like player goes, GM goes, player goes, GM goes, player goes, GM goes. And there is that, like, push and pull of dynamic between the players and the game masters. And I think that for anyone who's played like a Powered by the Apocalypse or a Fortune in the Dark system, that sort of push-pull of like that kind of there is this inherent thing in any improv performers will tell you this, or any actors will tell you this, of like, when you are performing with one another, you know how to take turns. Like, there is this notion of passing the ball between people. And in a group setting with like performers, a group of performers that have worked together for a while can actually naturally develop that sense of like how to pass the ball between each other and keep it fair. They don't need an initiative order because they follow the flow of the narrative. And so I get the sense that like that feedback comes from a lot of people who are reading Daggerheart, I think, in the expectation that it's going to be a Dragon Slayer game. And a lot of people that are looking for a Dragon Slayer, and I use the term Dragon Slayer to refer to like a game that's going to take on D&D and win. which, you know, okay. But a lot of people like put their hopes and their dreams of what the perfect TTRPG will be when into games like Daggerheart. I think Pathfinder's had it. I think that Tales of the Valiant's had it. I think that so many of these games that we've seen developing over the past 2 years have to deal with the weight of people's expectations on them. And that's almost where, like, I think, I hope that the devs of these systems take that feedback and that with a grain of salt with the expectations. Cause yeah, I wasn't surprised when Daggerheart didn't have an initiative system. And I'd be curious how many people are giving that feedback that are people who have maybe not played games that don't have initiatives before.
Well, that's why I think feedback surveys should have the very first question, I think, should be, did you play this or have you just read it? You know, it can be totally fine to still get that feedback from somebody who has only read it. But I think that it gives context to, all right, let's separate these piles so that we can look for patterns in these two piles to see that, oh, all the people who have read it have noticed this thing, but in play we can see it's actually not working.
Yes.
Or all the people who have read it have seen this thing, and in play, it's actually working. So maybe that's not a problem, you know? Because, yeah, you're right. I think a lot, you know, there's a couple of changes I want to comment on here that are coming from a pure place of, I haven't played it, but these are my initial thoughts on seeing that on paper. Speaking of which, so a couple of the changes that they've made, the optional initiative system, which is still pretty open in the way that they explain the optional initiative system. Players are now limited to 3 action tokens, but it says in the rules, but they could have more action tokens or less action tokens, depending on what's right for your group. So it's still pretty open. It's still not making any definitive statements. If the GM spends a character token from the action tracker to activate an adversary, the player doesn't get that token back. It kind of sits to the side, and players only refresh their 3 action tokens once everybody has spent all 3. And then they all go back on the character sheet and can be spent again. And the number of tokens, you know, as I've already said, per round, and round, I think, is my word, not the game's word, but the number of action tokens each player has per kind of, you know, sequence, can be raised or lowered depending on what the group finds to be the most enjoyable.
I think that's a good addition, because what that's really doing is it's solving a problem that some groups are going to have. I think their original system was fine as it is, but that's coming from a person who loves improv storytelling and who usually plays with people who, as Monty said, know how to pass the ball. But if there are a lot of times where you might end up in a group where some people don't know how to pass the ball. And if you are playing in a group where people don't know how to pass the ball, having an optional rule set to say, hey, this is going to force the ball to be passed, is beneficial. So although I don't think it was necessary for me as a player, I do think it's a good addition at large for the community.
I agree. I've been in that group with one player who thought he was the only one playing the game.
I'm sitting right here, Ben.
All right, other changes that they've made. I quite like this one, and I'll explain why again as someone who's only read it. But they've changed how advantage and help action works. So instead of getting an extra D6 to add to your 2D12 roll to raise the number of the check, instead you now roll 2 hope dice for a total of 3 dice on the roll, 1 fear, 2 hope. And choose which hope result to use. So you can take the lower hope result if it's going to get you that crit of rolling the same number on both dice, is how that's meant to function. And I like this because in game design, as a designer, what I really like and look for is elegance in design. And I think adding that extra D6 is a little inelegant. It's like, wait, now I've got to find this extra dice. I've got to have a D6 kind of sitting here off to the side. You probably do for damage in Daggerheart anyway, but it just feels really elegant to me that it's just that extra hope D12, and then you roll those together instead of adding kind of a I don't know, maybe this is even just a purely kind of like aesthetic change in terms of I prefer to roll 3d12 than adding an odd dice in there.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
no,
I like
absolutely.
That change anyway.
I hate it every time in D&D if it's like roll 3d6 and a d8 and I'm like, why? It's not aesthetically pleasing. Just make it 4d6 or 3d8 or something. Let it all be the same die all the time.
Yeah. Now I want to design something where you have to roll one of each die just for Kelly. D12.
It displeases me.
A player rolling with fear. And I'm assuming this is a combat focused change, but I could be wrong.
Fear.
Yeah,
when a player
the default state, yeah.
When a player rolls with fear, this allows the GM to collect fear, a fear token, a fear thing, a point of fear, or make a move in combat there and then, but not both. And I think I'm adding the combat bit there. I think the rules just, or the change that I saw was just make a move. So previously with the initiative system, you'd roll with fear or you'd fail a check and the GM would collect fear and then be able to activate an adversary. Now the GM either chooses to activate an adversary immediately or lets the players keep going but collects a fear token. The intention of this, I believe, is to slightly limit how much fear the GM is accruing at any given point within the game.
Or not make them have to come up with something each and every time, which is what I was talking about before of the non-storyteller experience DM or GM would have to come up with something each and every time that complicated the scene. Now they can just say, oh, I'll just take this fear and move on.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah. I understand that change a lot more now. That's good context.
I'm starting to get a picture painted in my mind, and maybe I'm off on this, but Daggerheart was created by professional performance folk who like it was created for Critical Role by Critical Role, if I'm not mistaken there, which it sounds like the system initially was perfect for their group. And we're also sitting here with a bunch of people who are kind of professional nerds. Not kind of, we are professional nerds. And so we also exist in the world where the system as it was first delivered was very appropriate for people who know how to put on a show with their games. But there's a lot of people out there who aren't as proficient at improv storytelling or just kind of like all of those things that we've talked about. So it sounds like each of these changes is them realizing that maybe they need to cater to an audience other than professional performers.
I agree. It seems to be gamifying it a little bit more.
People, especially if they do want to have like newer players and bring in a more people with varying levels of experience and comfort with different systems, I do think it is important that they the guidelines, because that is a hard thing. It's like coming up with a narrative result from every die roll can be challenging, and sometimes it's not as hard as it seems, but it definitely is a thing, right?
Sorry, go ahead, Kelly.
I was gonna say also, like, when you are coming up with those things, you try to be original. And I remember in a game of Monster of the Week, I didn't want to have my characters like trip for the 14th time. It's like trip because you rolled an average result and you drop whatever you were holding. And it's like, I can only do that so many times before that starts to feel like the generic go-to thing. So I think that's the problem with too many of those choices being thrown at you as a GM, is eventually you start to default, and defaulting breaks the magic of what those choices represent.
The last kind of big change here I want to talk about is players don't take stress when they are attacked, but the damage is lower than their minor damage threshold, making stress a more accessible resource because it's not getting forced upon the player just by purely taking damage or not taking damage in combat. Sean, did you feel that stress was something you didn't have much of, or you used it a lot?
That's the one thing I'm going to need to wait until this coming Wednesday to know, because we only played one combat and all the stress cleared right after we were done and we didn't play another one. So I'm looking forward to playing several combats in a row to see what that resource management part of the game looks like. Mm. But no, I did not feel like any of my resources were tapped too much. I did not feel like we failed too many rolls.
Sure. Okay. That's interesting.
And that may be part of the system and it may not, but that's just how it felt.
In these rolling games that you're going to be playing, do you think you're going to be keeping up with the updates, or do you think you'll play the earlier version?
We played 1.3 when we played last week. It came out the same day that we were going to play. Okay. So the game master just read them really quick and incorporated them into the game.
Well, speaking of incorporating things into your game, if you want more monsters to incorporate into your 5e game, you should check out Monsters of Drakenheim, which is currently crowdfunding on Kickstarter. Yeah. If you all point upwards, there will be a link somewhere, I think actually maybe in that direction, somewhere around there, you can find the link to it. Gents, we had you on just before the campaign launched. Now the campaign has launched. How are you feeling about how it's going so far?
Really excited. We've unlocked so many of our stretch goals along the way and been able to add such cool things to it. I think, you know, when Kelly and I are making lists of stretch goals, we're always like, are we sure we want to make this a stretch goal? We don't just want to put this in the book. you know, some of the really fun ones have already gone through, and we'll hopefully have more to unlock along the way.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is we made a lot more stretch goals for this one. So luckily, most of the ones that we were like that were kind of the oh god, I need this to be in the book were actually the earlier stretch goals. The later ones were like, wouldn't that be neat if? So we may not hit all the stretch goals this time, but that's our fault for making so many of them. But it is really exciting to see how it's done. And the buzz in our communities has been really fun to be a part of. We have, this is the first time for Kickstarter that we did a VIP Discord where you could get into the VIP Discord before the Kickstarter launched. And it's kind of like a mini community where we've been sharing like snippets of stuff we're working on and things like that. And just the excitement in that community has really been vibrant and it kind of makes me want to work harder on the book, which is nice because every day when I'm working, I pop in there. I'm like, what do you guys think of this? And then the chat blows up and I'm like, cool, I'm going to work harder on it now. For those of you watching who don't know, this is our third Kickstarter in the world of Drakenheim. It's a monster book. It's over 150 brand new monsters based in our world of Drakenheim, which is Eldritch horror, dark fantasy. You can use it if you're running a Drakenheim campaign, but if you just like creepy, spooky monsters that do new things that you've never seen monsters do before, then this is probably a great book for you to grab, I say, as my biased opinion.
No, I agree with you. I'm actually currently looking through Dungeons of Drakenheim, mining it for things for my Grim Hollow campaign, because I'm about to run something in my Grim Hollow campaign that I'm like, oh, I think actually there's a place like this in Dungeons of Drakenheim. Let me pull that out. Let me look at some of the monster stat blocks. And one of the stretch goals I'm actually love that it's a couple of the different stretch goals is the stat blocks for the different kind of factions and types of folk within Drakenheim, because I, as someone who runs a lot of dark fantasy where you want the monsters to kind of be a slow reveal and not necessarily just wandering around like packs of wolves in the wilderness, I love me a lot of NPC stat blocks to create dynamic humanoid conflicts before the world starts to get stranger as the party explore more of the weird places within it.
Those were definitely like the stretch goal. Like I felt that the more faction agents were some of the truest stretch goals for the book, because we knew that people in our audience really wanted more humanoid NPC stat blocks. It feels like to me that is like the one of the things that just the 5e community has the most voracious appetite for is monsters, but NPCs specifically, because they're so easily used in so many different contexts.
Yeah.
And we knew we wanted to do more of them. But it's a monster book. So you're like, how much of a monster book do you want to be just NPCs? And fortunately we blew through those stretch goals and people are super excited to get those stat blocks. And it's nice too, because like with the NPC stat blocks, they don't necessarily need the full treatment that the monsters do in terms of, in terms of like the lore and the layers, because they're all faction based. So the group of them all kind of share a lot of conceptual stuff.
Gotcha.
But it allows us to kind of take them as a whole to give the lore and the story behind them.
I think those stretch goals added 40 additional stat blocks to the book. So, we have between 7 and 10 for each faction, and there's 5 factions. So a little bit over 40, I think. I've been working away at those. And they're really fun because you also want to do something different than the already existing NPC stat blocks. And so what I'm trying to do is each faction has like a theme and a vibe that echoes through all of its stat blocks. So like I was just working on the Hooded Lanterns, and they're very mobile stat blocks. Like a lot of their characters are mobile archers who get bonuses if they're on elevated terrain. And they're really good at like navigating and climbing and doing all of that. Whereas I was working on the Silver Order, which is the Paladins, and they're very defense. Like they have a lot of like ways to mitigate damage and heal and kind of bolster each other up. So that's kind of their vibe. I haven't really worked on the rest yet, but I know that like, you know, when I work on the Queen's Men, they're going to be kind of backstabbing, tricksy, sort of care. Like, yeah, there's like a vibe that all of those stat blocks are going to have.
Yeah.
But then you're creating stat blocks at like from levels 1 up to level or CR 1 to CR 15, which really means that by the time you get all 40, if you aren't even running a Drakenheim campaign, you just have various kind of staples at every tier of play for all of these different vibes of characters.
Yes, which, and because the factions kind of roughly have like your rangers, your paladins, your clerics, your wizards,
and your rogues,
like they kind of hit the big archetypes.
I did a whole video about like how to run bandits and groups of humanoids to feel really threatening. You know, the just watched Sicario over the weekend, and I know that's a fictional movie, but nothing terrifies me more than like the horror that people do unto each other.
Yes.
And so that's why I love having lots of NPC stat blocks to create interesting encounters with, you know, individuals with varying skills and abilities. I love building what I call an anti-party, where I just create like, I grab 5 NPC stat blocks of roughly the same strength as the party, have a wizard, a fighter, you know, an automaton, something like that. And then just have that fight the party for a session.
Marty almost killed me a few weeks ago with one of those.
Right, there you go. Mm-hmm. If you haven't as well, we're final 10 days, I think, or possibly only 9 days, maybe even 8 days by the time this goes up, because the time zones are a little bit weird. But make sure to hit the links, which will be all around.
Yeah. We're getting towards the end. So yeah, back the Kickstarter. We've made it really easy this time, especially like, whether you want all the accessories or whether you play online only, however you play, like we want to make sure that you have the ability to get it. We have the D&D Beyond support coming right from when the project launches. So all of that is right in there. Check it out.
I'm not going to do a segue here because Dante's going to edit in the of the cinematic trailer.
But Dante doesn't have a voice on this podcast.
Nice.
Can that be the soundbite for the Dungeon Dudes from now on?
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, we mentioned the very sad passing of James M. Ward, who was very influential on the RPG industry. It's recently been reported that something that James was known for, the Metamorphosis Alpha RPG, which was one of the first sci-fi RPGs, has been sold, the rights for it have been sold and its derivative works to Parabellum Consulting, Apparently, you're going to hear a lot more of them. They've already got Kickstarters in the planning stages for publishing some of Jim's previously unseen work, in addition to some new editions of their previously published work. Apparently, this sale happened actually before Jim's passing, and is a way for their legacy to continue on. It's kind of not news. I don't think we need to report every time Chris Cox blows his nose, but I became aware of this interview that Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro, did on WBUR-FM, which is a radio station. But the interview has been transcribed. I'm just going to copy it into an article that I'm going to post the link in the chat right now, mainly because I want folks to be able to go and make up their own minds about what's being said here. But there are some interesting kind of tidbits to pull out. So I'm just kind of going to go through those sort of one at a time, and we can comment on them if we want, or we can let them go through to the keeper. On a radio, Chris Cox claims apparently that satisfaction rates and the happiness of players, customers of Hasbro at large, I think he'd be talking about really, but possibly also D&D, are higher than ever. So players are happier than they've ever been. I don't know what metrics he's measuring that by, but cool.
Hey, if you go by Baldur's Gate 3, I'm sure they are.
I mean, is everybody here having a good time playing D&D? I think I am. So.
Yeah, I'm having a good time playing D&D.
I mean, yeah. Satisfaction cool. With like Wizards of the Coast, I guess. Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah. Now that's a different question, but because I haven't bought any of the new books in a little while. I should probably grab one or two of them, but I also haven't ran any of the adventures, also, so.
It also, like, but I don't need to buy any of the books anymore because they've been sending them to us. So we got our lovely champagne bucket with wine glasses
from
Wizards that
and fashionable glasses.
Yeah, I was just like, where's the champagne?
Is it legal to send alcohol in the mail?
I don't think it is.
Especially across country borders.
I was going to say, I thought that box was going to be full of books. And then I was very confused when we opened it. And I was like, what is this? What's happening here?
Is it my birthday? All right. He was asked some interesting questions. A lot of those questions you get barely CEO sort of answers to. But, you know, take them how you will, I suppose. The first question was about the layoffs that happened at the end of last year and why they happened. And I think his answer is actually relatively interesting. He talks about the need to preserve the cost base of Hasbro. We know this was a reason given that it was a cost-saving exercise. What he talks about, though, that I found interesting is that a lot of those, whilst those layoffs did obviously cut into Wizards of the Coast, the vast majority of them, according to Chris Cox in this interview, affected the toy side of the Hasbro company and the support structures there. And that Hasbro are pivoting more towards gaming as their primary company model, as opposed to toys and gaming. I suppose what separates those two being like toys would be action figures, maybe costumes, you know, that kids, you know, get the Spider-Man gloves that shoot the goo, you know, those sort of, I don't think Hasbro has the license to Spider-Man, but you get what I mean. Whether as gaming is more like D&D, Magic the Gathering, video games, probably board games like Monopoly as well, those sort of things. Which leads into the next question about, are folks playing more games and why Chris Cox thinks that is? And he said that games have a higher growing market than toys do, that games grow in the high single digit percentage each year, whereas toys grow maybe 2 or 3% each year as a market. And that the reason for this is because people are playing games at older and older ages. They're not dropping off as teenagers as much anymore. Mm. They're kind of playing into their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know.
Forever.
But also, forever, virtually. But yeah. I think it's also, you know, with millennials as a generation, I know this is not a hard and fast rule, but I think with millennials as a generation, maybe even starting with Gen Xers, that play does carry on a lot longer through adulthood than it might have with previous generations, you know, collectibles, nostalgia, all that sort of thing kind of has become a lot more marketable in recent years for more adults to be, you know, 21 and plus to be more invested in gaming. This is me conjecturing, by the way. This is not part of Chris Cox's answer. But what Chris Cox does say is also that younger generations, people around, I assume, the 10-year mark, are also getting into gaming sooner. Video games, D&D, Magic the Gathering, and playing less with toys. That's his conjecture as to why the toy market is not growing compared to the game market and why Hasbro as a company is shifting away from toys to focus more on games.
Without a doubt. Parents, young parents, are not handing their six-year-olds dolls anymore or cars or models or things like that because they only keep the kid busy for an hour. Whereas a tablet keeps them busy for days, weeks, months, years. And what do you put on those tablets? Well, you can put TV shows, but you also put games on them. So that's why the market is growing in that direction, as well as what you said, Ben.
I mean, I think about my own life and how I remember at a young age getting my first Nintendo. And even then, assuming that this was something that I did in my youth and knowing that like my parents, I'm like, my parents don't play these video games. These are for me as a child. Now here I am moving towards 40 and I play more video games than I ever did as a kid. And like, yeah. I'm still playing board games. I'm playing way more different board games. Like we used to have like Monopoly or Clue Night with my family growing up. Now I have like friends over to play like Darkest Dungeon, the board game, or, you know, like wild board game nights that where we try like three or four games that nobody's ever heard of. And I love buying new board games that sound cool. I got one. I'm gonna screw up the name. I got one recently called like Noctis Inferno, where like you play as necromancers trying to summon demons. And I'm inviting a few friends over next weekend to play that. And I'm excited. Like board game nights are a social event now as an adult. And like these are all things that I thought I wasn't going to be doing because watching my parents, I was like, right, once I am an adult, I work at a job and I no longer play games. Well,
yeah.
Who's laughing now? My job is playing games. So,
yeah.
You know, an interesting thing that Chris Cox said in the interview around why the gaming market, the toys to gaming market is shifting, and he doesn't elaborate on it in the interview. So I didn't initially know what he meant, but he just kind of mentioned birth rates, you know, changing birth rates. But I don't know whether he meant birth rates are increasing or decreasing. And I didn't go in to do more research on that specific term. The only reason I bring that up is, you know, Kelly, I agree. I reflect on my own kind of life choices and my wife and I joke constantly that we have dink life, which is that double income, no kids, you know, we don't need to spend money or time on children. That's just a lifestyle choice that we've made. And I've just, you know, the same as you, there was never a point at which I was like, I am adult now. I have fully formed from the chrysalis and now I have no interest in games. You know, I'm still doing the things I was doing when I was six. Literally, I'm still doing the things I was doing when I was 16 because I'm still painting miniatures and wargaming and I've got, you know, boxes of The Witcher, you know, board game in my cupboard that I'll crack out at some point. You know, I feel like a big kid in many ways. And I don't know whether that's some, you know, millennial experience, you know, that we never really grew up. But the older I get, the more appreciation I get that nobody ever has the experience of like, I am adult now, you know?
Yeah, it's a weird thing that happens. You become an adult and you're like, oh, my parents were just kids figuring it out. We all are just kids who have gotten older and have to pay taxes and, you know.
The only time that breaks is when very suddenly I have to talk about teaching because I was a teacher for a few years. As soon as I start talking about education, I feel like I'm, you know, yes, 30 years older than I am. All right. Chris Cox was asked, to rewind back. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Speaking of 30 years older than you are.
Oh.
Sean, do you still feel like a kid?
Absolutely. I will never grow up and it's a joyful thing.
There you go.
All right. Chris Cox was asked about the OGL walk back at the end of last year. We try to think beyond just social media spaces and who's playing our games who don't have social media accounts. That's me paraphrasing a little bit, kind of saying that, yes, there was a large amount of outcry online, but that they're trying to think of people who don't necessarily have those accounts and what's best for the company to service people who aren't vocal, I suppose. That's me paraphrasing a little bit again. Please read the article, which I'll link to draw your own conclusions from what he's saying. But then he also kind of clarifies that they're continuing to work with their creator community, meaning third-party publishers is what I took him to say there. Obviously, a lot of third-party publishers have come to D&D Beyond recently, and online streamers and people who make D&D content to make the game as big as possible.
So much to say. We only have, what, 30 seconds? Oh, so much to say.
He was asked about Magic the Gathering oversaturation in terms of, you know, apparently the stock was decreased on Hasbro when they started putting out more Magic than anybody had an appetite for. And Chris Cox's answer was just like, nah, brah, Magic has been tripled in size in the past 5-6 years. So that was that.
Was
answer.
That a direct quote? Did he say no?
Yeah, that one was a direct quote.
Yeah.
And also asked about whether Hasbro is more focused on video games after the success of Baldur's Gate compared to cinema, considering the disappointing eventuation of the D&D movie. And Chris Cox says, we're focusing on everything, kitchen sink kind of approach. They've got TV shows and movies apparently that are currently in development or being at the planning stages. So he didn't say what those were, whether they're sequels or, you know, we know what they're not. They're not Dragonlance. yeah. So that's what he said. That's the Chris Cox corner.
I don't think I'm alone in saying that I actually would love a sequel to the Dungeons and Dragons movie. I would love those characters to come back. I want to see more of them. I think the movie was phenomenal. Not the best movie I've ever seen in my life, like not Oscar worthy, but the biggest disappointment about that movie is how it's being labeled as a disappointment.
I agree,
because I thought it was the best Dungeons and Dragons movie we've ever gotten. And I mean, that bar is pretty low, but it set the bar where I think is actually a pretty high place.
I really enjoyed that movie and I feel like there's a part of me that wonders, like, if that movie had have been made in a world where Guardians of the Galaxy didn't exist, you know, it would have been, I feel like people would have loved it almost as much as like the first Guardians movie. Cause I remember coming out of the first Guardians movie thinking, oh, this is the D&D movie that we've always wanted.
Right.
It really felt like it. And I had similar feelings of excitement and emotion watching the D&D movie that I did to Guardians.
I still yell Jarnathan all the time, like that. Jarnathan.
Jarnathan's my BFF.
Yeah,
my hero.
We love Jarnathan.
Yeah, I agree completely. Before the movie came out, you know, we talked about it here on the Lorecast a couple of times. Anytime there was a new trailer or something dropped, and or some piece of news, some cast member was asked a question, and I remember Chris Pine saying like, it's kind of like Princess Bride meets Guardians of the Galaxy. And I remember at the time, and I probably even said it on this podcast, I don't know, that sounds like a weird thing. That doesn't make me feel hopeful about it. And then I saw the movie and I was like, no, that is exactly what that movie is Princess Bride meets Guardians of the Galaxy. And 100%. It is perfect. And I love watching Hugh Grant just have the most fun that he looks like he's ever had in a role before, except for maybe The Gentleman. He's also very, very fun in The Gentleman. But speaking of gentlemen, these four need to get out of here because we are over time. I just looked at the time and I was like, oh my gosh. So I'm going to wrap this up quickly. This has been the Eldritch Lorecast. Like, subscribe, those things, stars if you're listening to us on a podcast. Go check out the Dungeon Dudes YouTube channel where you can find Monty and Kelly and everything that they're up to. Go check out the Kickstarter for Monsters of Drakenheim if you want to add more Eldritch horrors and NPCs to your game. Let's get out of here. My name's Ben Byrne, here with Kelly McLaughlin, Monty Martin, Sean Merwin, and we will be back next week for another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.
Cheers. Love it.
Bye 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 bye.
We need a metal version of blah 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 blah.
That's right.
Yeah. officially.
Like that?
Yes. That was metal. That's what all metal sounds like.
Exactly.
Yeah.